You're listening to Stories That Matter, a Hawkwood podcast. In this episode, Vicky Livingston-Thompson, CEO of Inclusion Gloucestershire, on the importance of user-led organisations, how fear impacts diversity in the workplace, and what policies she'd like to see talked about in the run-up to the general election.
So I'm Vicky Livingston-Thompson. I'm Chief Exec here at Inclusion Gloucestershire, and I have been for just over a year, but I've been involved with the organisation in one way or another since 2013. And so I set up a little user-led organisation for physically disabled people in 2013. That was just after I'd graduated from university. And later down the line, we merged with another organisation to form Inclusion Gloucestershire, and here I am. So I set up the user-led organisation because I'm a disabled person myself, and I'm really lucky that I've had a lot of opportunities throughout my life, and because of that I've been able to go to university, I've had brilliant opportunities to travel, I've got a great group of friends, and I reached the point where I graduated with a degree in business and was looking at graduate jobs in London with big companies and just didn't quite feel excited about that. And I thought, you know, I want to do something that feels meaningful and that makes a difference, which probably sounds quite cliched, but when you're spending huge chunks of your life at work, it has to be something you believe in. And in Gloucestershire, there was a gap around support, particularly user-led or self-advocacy support for physically disabled people. And I had some contacts at the council, some very supportive commissioners who agreed that I could do a bit of a feasibility study, and then I applied for funding to set up a user-led organisation, and we went from there.
What kind of things were you doing?
So early on we were doing a lot around providing information, advice. We also were quality checking care services, which is something that we still do as Inclusion Gloucestershire. So we go out and do user-led quality checks, so they're done by disabled people, of care settings to make sure that people are really getting really good person-centred support to live the lives that they want to live. So we did kind of a few projects on a small scale in the early days. Also lots of consultation and co-production to make sure that disabled people have a voice. And now as Inclusion Gloucestershire, we're doing a lot of the same on a bigger scale. We're doing some new things as well. And we've got just over 40 staff, so we've grown. The majority of our staff, 65%, have a disability themselves, and that's really valuable because they get it.
And does doing that, this kind of work, make you feel excited?
It really does. I love it. It's challenging, and the days are long, and I never completely switch off, which drives those around me mad sometimes, you know, when it's a Sunday evening and I've just got to quickly check my emails because there's an important meeting happening on Monday, and my partner will say, you know, it's just a job, but it's not to me, just a job. And so I love it. I always come into work excited, sometimes with a little bit of trepidation, depending what's on the agenda for that day. But it's never boring. And, you know, just at the end of the week or the end of the month, when I'm looking at our figures, our monitoring, what we've done, the case studies of individuals we've worked with, it's really clear what a difference we're making.
Why is it more than a job for you, do you think?
Well, I guess the cause is something I'm passionate about. You know, equal opportunities for people with disabilities, giving people a voice, challenging perceptions, raising aspirations. And also my degree and my very early work was in business. So I've always quite liked contract management, money management, people management. And running a charity is exactly the same as running a business. You've just got slightly different values or principles to work towards, and obviously you're not making a profit. So I'm really lucky that I get to do something I'm passionate about that also aligns with kind of my career interests and skills, so it's perfect.
Can you explain a bit more about being a user-led organisation? Like, what does that mean?
So being user-led means we're run by disabled people for disabled people. So the technicalities are that the majority of our board, so 3/4, have lived experience of disability. And obviously the board make the really big decisions about things like what direction we should be going in, signing off our budget and agreeing our 3-year strategy, all those big things. And then the operational team deliver that. And within the operational team, the majority of staff are disabled too. And we've got that representation at every level in the organisation. So it's definitely not just lip service. I'm passionately against tokenism, so we have people in roles that fit their skills and experience, and so we have people with lived experience in senior management roles, and then kind of at a project worker level, and we find that by delivering projects through staff with that experience, people relate better to them, they've got a level of authenticity, they've got better understanding, and that experience, that lived experience, can be far more valuable than a degree or, you know, 10 years working in management, which are important for some roles, but certainly not all.
Being user-led seems like really intuitively the right thing to do, but a lot of charities aren't user-led. Do you think you're kind of radical in that way?
I think we're unique, and it would be wrong to say that there aren't some challenges around being user-led. There are challenges that are well worth overcoming.
What are some of those challenges, do you think?
Well, for example, our overhead costs are very high, or compared to other sectors or organisations, and that's because some of our staff need a lot more support, so we need to put in a lot of back office support, so staff time, to do things like issuing everyone with an easy read contract. All our policies and procedures are in Easy Read.
Sorry, can you just explain what Easy Read is?
Of course. So Easy Read is written information in an accessible format. So It uses pictures to explain some concepts. It also uses short, clear sentences, no long words and no jargon. So if you imagine a typical data protection policy, it's like the other end of the spectrum to easy read. So we get these policies, and obviously because they're legal, they need to be written in a certain way. So we'll have the standard policy, but then we've got staff who'll spend a lot of time putting all those policies into easy read. And likewise with things like our training, for some of our staff, they can just go off and do online training on safeguarding or person-centred approaches, and that's great. Some of our staff don't read or write or use a computer, that has other brilliant skills, but they still need that training, so we need to find a way to deliver it and make it meaningful. So, and there are kind of, there's additional support that's needed. And also there are challenges as well as huge value in having such a diverse workforce. So I think every workforce, regardless of sector, should be really diverse. But to make that work, you need to be mindful of how different people might need different things. So there are many situations where it can be a challenge to cater for everyone. But we just say, you know, we all try our best. We all support each other. We're a very supportive workforce. And, you know, people are great at compromising.
How do you think you can encourage other workplaces to be more diverse?
I think a lot of the lack of diversity comes from fear. So where workforces don't have a very diverse workforce, it can be quite scary. I remember in one of my first jobs in marketing, I was only there for 6 months. It was a great job though. And at the end of the 6 months, they did a little leave-in do for me. And my manager told me after a few drinks, he said, "Vicky, when we interviewed you, you were great on paper. We thought this girl is going to be fantastic." And then you turned up to the interview, and you were obviously disabled, but you still did well at interview. But afterwards we said to ourselves, we've been running as an organisation for over 20 years and we've never had a disabled member of staff. Now, I suspect personally that they had had disabled staff but didn't realise, but their perception was that they hadn't. And he said, we sat after that interview and said, will this work? And our biggest fear was how the other staff would react to you. Would they respect you? Would they work with you? Would they kind of undermine you? And he said, but we thought, no, let's take this risk. And they did, and it was amazing. And I loved the other staff team. We got on really well. We worked great as a team. So in the 6 months that I was in that role, they recruited another individual with a disability. So they'd gone from 20 years of no one that they were aware of to 2 in 6 months. And I think that just shows if you give it a go, you find there's nothing to scared, or if you have a really positive experience, and then that opens the door to this huge workforce with brilliant skills that they might have wrongly not considered before.
How did you feel when he was telling you that? Because I'd be quite upset, I think, if someone said that to me.
I think having lived with a disability and the discrimination and attitudes that it brings, it was completely unsurprising. So it's frustrating. In a way, it was refreshing to hear someone say it, because it's something that I'd suspected happened a lot. I went to lots of interviews. When I was applying for jobs, I would get asked to interview for nearly every job I applied for. And some of my friends had asked me to help them write their applications, because they say, "You're so good, Vicky, you always get the interview." And because on paper I am good, and then at nearly every single interview I didn't even get past the first stage. And I'm sure it was because, you know, people see on paper this individual with these grades and this degree and this experience, and don't expect a disabled person to walk through the door and aren't sure what that will mean. So it wasn't surprising. And I think I just thought, well, that confirms what I suspected, but I felt glad that I'd had the opportunity to change that perception.
There's been a lot in the news over the last few years about how austerity has affected people with disabilities. Is that something that you've seen in your work?
Definitely. So we see that people with disabilities are really disproportionately affected by austerity. So it feels like they are particularly vulnerable, and I don't normally like the word vulnerable, but in this case it's absolutely apt.
Why do you not like the word vulnerable?
I think the word vulnerable, it suggests a power dynamic in which the vulnerable person has no power and the rest of society does. So I, for some things, will be classed as a vulnerable individual or a vulnerable adult because I have a disability. But in fact, anyone who knows you will tell you, you know, I'm feisty, I'm independent, I own my own home, I drive around in my own car, I'm more than able to have my say. My partner will probably say he's completely under the sun and I'm not vulnerable at all. So the word vulnerable suggests that people are kind of unable to support themselves. It's disempowering. But in some circumstances, like in austerity, disabled people are disempowered and they are vulnerable because they're at the mercy of decision makers and politicians who can make decisions that have a huge impact on lives and in some cases kill people. So we've seen in Gloucestershire quite a few people who've had their support packages cut and have gone on to die at quite young ages from completely avoidable causes. And if they had been better supported, they wouldn't have died because they'd have accessed health services, they'd have, you know, been eating a proper diet, they wouldn't have been living in freezing cold and safe homes.
That's really shocking, but why do you think there isn't more of a public outcry about it?
I think that often these stories go untold. So for a lot of disabled people, unless they have either advocates or they're part of a collective who have a strong voice, their story goes unheard. So we're much better at being outraged by the conditions that some older people live in, because we're probably all going to get old, so it strikes a chord. But for a lot of the population, unless you know or love someone who's disabled, it can feel like quite a distant concept. And I think for some people there's still a lot of stigma and misconceptions around benefits, you know, that all disabled people are on benefits, so they're taken care of and that's fine. That's definitely not the case. Some disabled people might get a little bit of support, and they then are at the mercy of that support changing. And it's such a small amount, normally it's an amount that can't be lived on. And of course, disabled people on average have much higher living costs. I think it was found to be about £500 a month in addition, and that's for things like extra heating, transport, you know, extra washing, laundry, if you have a disability that means your clothes get messy more often. So there are these huge additional costs, much lower on average income, whether that's earned income or some welfare support. And for many people, they're just in a situation that they can't survive in.
So going into the general election, what were some issues that you'd like to see the parties campaigning on?
I would like to see changes to universal credit, not just for disabled people, but for vulnerable people or people who need that extra bit of support on the whole. I think the system at the moment does not work. I would like to see the NHS safeguarded. I think the NHS does a brilliant job, and for people with long-term conditions, that's particularly important. And I'd like to see a lot more investment into social care. So we know that social care budgets have massively been cut in the last 10 years, and it's that which is having a huge impact on people who rely on either care at home or in the community or in a care setting. And I think those are the people who we most need to safeguard, and at the moment it's not happening.
There's quite a lot of talk at the moment about how we can all be good allies to people who face discrimination, whether that's from sexuality or race or gender or anything. What to you makes a good ally?
A good ally is definitely someone who identifies where they might be in a position of privilege. So whether that's a male saying, I'm not a female and I understand that you might be in a situation that I don't understand, but I would like to understand and I would like to support, you know, the journey of the fight to equality. Likewise, it's a non-disabled person saying, Vicky, I understand that you probably get undermined a lot. So if we're in a meeting and someone asks your opinion, I'm never going to cut in and finish your sentence. So it's recognising the privilege that you might have as kind of a non-minority or non-discriminated against group. It's listening and hearing the story of the other group, and, you know, understanding that you don't know it all. And it's supporting in a way that the group or the individual identifies as most helpful.
I'm going to go on to my last question now, so the name of this podcast is Stories That Matter. And so is there a story from your life, it can be fact, it can be fiction, something you've heard or that you've experienced that's really influenced what you're doing now?
So an example that actually comes up regularly, it still does, so it's a recurring story, is and it's to do with the attitudes that people have. So at work, we've got a staff team of over 40, and as the chief exec, I don't often answer the phone. We've got a brilliant admin team who are much better at answering the phone, fielding calls, transferring them. But occasionally, particularly on a Friday afternoon when the office is quiet, I will answer the phone. And often, I will get people who will say, "Can I speak to someone in charge?" Or, "I need to speak to someone higher up." And I will say, "Oh, I'm very sorry, but this is as good as you're going to get. I'm the chief exec." And sometimes I think they don't believe me because someone has answered the phone who speaks a bit differently, so it can be identified as disabled. And they've made an immediate assumption that I don't know what I'm doing. Or it might be that they ask for someone and I say, "Oh, I'm very sorry, that individual isn't in, can I help?" And I'll sometimes get the answer, "No, I don't think you can." When in fact, as the chief exec who's got an overview of the whole organisation, I've got access to every file on our server. If I want to help, I probably can. But that immediately means I think, "That's fine, I'll just leave. You can wait until whoever it is back in the office." And so it's those kind of assumptions. And it happens as well when I'm in meetings. I'm often in regional or national meetings, and you'll walk in, and I know that some of the professionals around the table will look at me and think, "Oh, that's nice, they've let a token disabled woman come into this meeting, but she's probably not going to understand what we're talking about. We're talking about the NHS long-term plan and funding strategies for the next 10 years for healthcare, and so she'll probably have nothing to add." And then when I open my mouth and contribute my thoughts, you know, and it might be around, "What is the sustainability of this section of the plan? And how will Brexit affect nursing levels?" And so you see them think, "Oh God, she might know what she's talking about." So it's this constant perception that as a disabled person, I find myself fighting against all the time. And that drives me, because I think when I see that little kind of dawn of realisation, whether it's a person on the phone they realise, "Oh God, you know, this is a disabled person who's a really valued member of this organisation." And so that makes me do what I do, because I think all disabled people are valuable, and we just need to educate society and give everyone the opportunity to shine and show all the brilliant things they're capable of.
Sounds exhausting.
It is. It is exhausting. And gin and tonic helps me through. So I get home from work. I often work in the evenings, but have a nice gin and tonic, sit down on the sofa, and I take a couple of hours off educating the world.
Thanks for listening to Stories That Matter, a Hawkwood podcast. If you've enjoyed this podcast, please do tell your friends. This episode was produced by Laura Bing, with music by Daisy and Her Cora, playing an original composition, Berta.